The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. And welcome back to our second evening of the Intro to Mindfulness Series 2. And for those of you here last week, I handed out a handout of exercises or checklists to do after your meditation at home. And before I start here with the topic for today, I'm curious to hear from some of you what it was like to track your meditation that way. Anybody like to comment on it? Yes, if you could, maybe Rob, could you pick it for the mic?
Hi, I'm Charlene, and I thought it was really a great experience for me to have these touchstones to think about after my meditation, and it was mostly the same except for one day when I had a bad day at work, and then I really noticed a lot of restlessness, and I think the main thing I wanted to share with the group was that I didn't try to push away this experience that I had at work. I remembered what you had said about just let it be there and maybe create a softening around it. And I did that, and I felt like I'd been to an hour-long therapy session or something. It was really awesome, and it was therapeutic for me, and today it resolved at work and even got better.
Wonderful. Thank you. Yes?
Hi, I'm Ronald. I wasn't here last week, but Julie, who teaches over at Avenidas, filled me in kind of on what you're up to. So, there was no real... it was kind of uncomfortable sitting there with, the thoughts kind of unpleasant, like sensations, like I'm tired or thoughts about, my present insecurities about this and that. So it was actually kind of not pleasant.
Your meditation was not pleasant.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. That can often happen. If we have an unpleasant life, then if we're more present, we'll be aware of that unpleasantness.
Right.
And it's counterintuitive that it's useful to stay present for that. But we say in Buddhism that it's we use meditation, mindfulness practice, to really acknowledge what is true. And that when we acknowledge what's true, there's a path to be that opens up there. To freedom. And if things are unpleasant, the path is not found by closing that door, by turning away from it, by opening it and being present, and then learning, like the lady there talked about, maybe softening attention that holds that. A lot of learning to be done there. Anybody else about the exercise, the checklist, meditation checklist? Any comments about how that was to do that?
I found it very interesting. I like the more active acknowledging what you're feeling or doing or thing. What I realized is about halfway through the week, I thought I was always putting down that desire was my most present hindrance, but only because it was like by default. I wasn't really thinking there, gee, I want something or I wish this, or I want pie for dinner, or anything that clear. But then I realized that what I tend to do, and I wrote down, what's the difference between like desire and imagination? And I realized that what I do is I tend to go into these little imaginary stories or conversations and this and that and the other. And the point of many of them is for me to look good. Mm. So it was desire. It basically, I desired to look good to people. I want to be admired. I'm sorry to say that, but it's true. And Well, thank you. It worked. but to me, that was, I actually learned something quite interesting there.
Yes. Beautiful. So the checklist on the hindrances was useful for you, and it prompted you to look more closely at what was going on there. And there's still, you could even look even closer at some point, and it might be interesting to see if there's a condition that prompts the arising of wanting to look good. Before wanting to look good desires kind of comes up, it's kind of subtle, but before that, what is there first? Because it might be that desire is responding to a previous condition. And that could be very subtle, but it could be important to see because it's the genesis for. And it might be more useful to address the root cause than it is to address that particular desire. Anybody else would like to share a little bit?
I found it an interesting exercise, but I found as I started to fill out the checklist time and time again, it somewhat challenging because as I filled it out, I started thinking about, you know, the definitions of some of the terms and realizing that mindfulness, well, I didn't really know what mindfulness was, or maybe I didn't know the difference in the hindrances between anxiety and doubt and these sorts of issues. So I had kind of a hard time filling out the checklist because of that. And I think maybe the high variability of the scores that I noted had to do with that confusion.
Great, okay. No, it's quite understandable that you might be confused about some of them and not so clear. There are more technical meanings for these in Buddhism. You can learn them if you study some more. For the purpose of this exercise here, it might not be so, it might be less important, the technical meaning, but rather the meaning that's obvious to you. So rather than trying to think, what does Gil have in mind? What does anxiety or what does doubt mean for you, and how do you differentiate them, if you do? Or the fact that you can't separate them very much, that's very interesting in itself. Because then what's the relationship then between anxiety and doubt and anxiety? They go hand in hand, and that could open up doors for you. But with some of these words, I mean, it's for your sake you're doing this, not for my sake. So your definition of mindfulness probably was good enough. So I saw another hand here.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Brian. So I noticed a few things that were interesting. The most obvious is that I'm missing a few days in here, where I think with the beginner series, I never missed a day. And the other thing that just since the beginner series, I've kind of experimented with meditating in the morning or meditating at night, and just really came down to daily schedule and when I can do it. But I thought, you know, there's really no difference between the two. It's just time of day. But what this kind of exposed for the days that I did do it is that there was a very different quality of meditation between morning and night, with night being much more calm. And I had there was more quiet in the thinking mind, more enjoyment. And then during the day, it just seemed like I was probably thinking about work or was focused on different things. So I had maybe more mindfulness and more motivation and more concentration, but also felt a lot more intense also. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting to see the quality difference between meditating and my state of mind at night versus in the morning.
Great. Wonderful. And so that information then can be useful in deciding when it's most useful for you to meditate, when it's most productive, when it's the best time. Also, as you begin separating out all the different elements that go on, the differences between different times and all that, and then there can be a heightened awareness of what's actually happening when you meditate. Now you've seen this. So next time you meditate, you'll start noticing, there are differences. Oh, now it's evening, so now I'm more peaceful, or now I'm during the day, I'm thinking about work. And the more you can be aware of what's happening in the present moment, the better the mindfulness can unfold. So one of the hopes I had with this exercise was that I didn't want you to be now constantly thinking, you know, as you meditate, you know, where am I, what's the present, any of these things present so much. But that by reflecting on them after your meditation, then they're kind of there naturally, maybe mildly, but naturally there while you meditate. So when desire arises or when restlessness arises, or when good energy arises, that you'll recognize it. Oh yeah, that's there. And it's a very simple, very, very simple kind of brightening of the mind or brightening of presence as you recognize more what's going on. So I don't know, did any of you have that experience? That just the checklist itself helped you be more present during the meditation? Yes? Great. Okay. So this is something you might find interesting to continue doing. Take that checklist and continue it for a month or so, and then also begin tracking what happens over longer time spans, how things shift and change. And as you see how things shift and change in meditation, then you'll also begin to understand better, perhaps, what daily life activities and situations impact meditation. And also maybe the other direction, how meditation then relates to what happens in daily life. You see how things change and shifts. So one of the ways that this kind of checklist kind of helps us to see is start seeing how things do change over time. Some things improve. If you kept doing this over years, you probably see a growth of certain of these good qualities and a decrease in the more difficult ones, or how they change depending on causes and conditions. But you see how they change. When we see that things are changing all the time, it's often a result that people will take them less personally or lighten up a little bit around them. When we think that they're solid and just fixed the way they are, there's often a tendency to take them quite seriously. And there's a delusion. Buddhism talks a lot about delusions. There's one that's called the delusion of permanence. And when my first son was young, I would sometimes fall into the delusion of permanence when he was kind of a high-need kid when he was young. And so it was kind of very demanding at home, a little bit stressful because of his high energy needs, just all the way he was. And there was sometimes I'd fall into the delusion of permanence. It wasn't so conscious. It wasn't like I was thinking. But it was kind of emotionally, like, oh no, it's going to be this way forever. This is it. You know, he's going to be jumping off the walls and off the ceiling forever, you know, whatever it might be, whatever's going on. And a couple of times when one of these days was happening, it was just like, my wife would look at me and say, Gil, we're having one of those kinds of days. And just that statement, oh, just one of those kinds of days, it's not going to be this way forever. It's just today, it's just this hour. And stepping back and just seeing it that way and realizing things do change from day to day, from week to week, I lightened up and I didn't succumb to the burden of what it's this delusion of permanence. I'm always going to be depressed. I'm always going to be a loser. I'm always going to, you know, it's always going to be raining, whatever it might be. There's a very strong tendency, even without logically thinking about it, to relate to things that, as if they're kind of, this is it. Even though, logically, we might know it's impermanent. So to learn not to take these things so solidly is very helpful. When people go on meditation retreats, we do retreats that sometimes can be long as 10 days. And one of the sources of wisdom that can happen after a person does two or three of these retreats is the first day of the retreat, they're just so happy to be there. You know, away from their busy life, things are calm, people are cooking for them. It's just so good to be there. Wow, this is like nirvana, beautiful. And then the second day, all their tiredness catches up to them. And they're just like, you know, can't stay awake and just everything's so hard because they're so tired. And they think, what was I thinking coming on a retreat? This is a disaster. And then the third day, the tiredness is over and then you drop into some real nice calm. Oh, it's so calm. This is great. I'll tell my friends about it. And the fourth day, there was enough calm that some of the deep-seated anxiety you've carried all your life kind of begins to bubble up. And now you're so anxious and you say, you know, I wonder if I can get they give me my money back if I can leave now. And then the fifth day, that anxiety drops away and then you feel all this love for the other people in the retreat and just feel like, how can I feel so much love and my heart is so full? This is really the best ever. So after a while, doing enough of these, people catch on. And one thing they catch on, they say, oh, it's changing. It changes in the course of the retreat. This is, it's like this one day or 1 hour or one meditation, then it'll change and be a little bit different, another meditation, another day. And with that realization, most people then lighten up. Because if you take it, oh, this is it, you know, this is it, I'll be tired forever. This is the, like, this defines my whole 10-day retreat. That's delusion of permanence. But you say, oh, just that day, then it's a lot easier. So as people do a lot of meditation and track what's going on in meditation, sometimes what we'll see is things are changing a lot in their meditation. And that change, you see that change is a big part of what goes on, then it's possible to not take it so personally, to hold it lighter, not to grasp onto it or resist it so much. And so some of the more ease of meditation comes when we allow things to be as they are, without making a big deal of them, without interpreting them as this is it. Make some sense? Now, in, there's a classic story in Buddhism, kind of a little parable that the Buddha gives, of a king who asked his ministers to bring a group of blind people to the palace. And when this group of blind people came, he brought out the royal elephant. And he had the blind people go up to the elephant, and different blind people touched different parts of the elephant. And then they came back and they were supposed to report what an elephant is like. So the person who felt the legs said, oh, an elephant is like a big column. That's what an elephant is like. The person who felt the tusk said, oh, an elephant is like a plow. The person who felt the big ears said, oh, that's like a winnowing basket. It's a big flat basket they used to use. The person who felt the big belly said, oh, an elephant is like a big storeroom. The person who felt the head said, oh, the elephant is like a big jar. Which one has the right idea of what an elephant is? Well, none of them do. All of them are partial. And but when the eyesight is returned, then you step back and you see the elephant is not each of those individual things, but the elephant is something different. So this story is told in Buddhism with the idea that often the way we experience life is partial. We don't see the full picture. We don't see clearly what's there. Often we don't see because of the delusion of permanence, or we somehow lock on to certain, we have certain bias, we see certain things certain ways. We have certain prejudice about how we see things, what we think is important in any given situation, so we see it through the spectrum of what we think is important. One vantage point that people often look at things at is how it relates to me, myself, and mine. And there are other vantage points besides me, myself, and mine, but people sometimes can get stuck in there. So one of the functions of mindfulness meditation is to help open up the vista, open up the awareness, so we're not stuck in a preconceived ideas, we're not stuck in a narrow image of what's happening. And so the mindfulness vipassana means to see clearly or to see openly, to see without partiality, to see what's there. And so this is one of the things I want to talk about today, the beginning to see more clearly. The word vipassana, pasana means to see, and vi means to see clearly. So our name, Insight Meditation Center, the insight is this, what we're going to talk about today, developing insight. Now, in order to develop insight or use the mindfulness we see clearly, it's more than just acknowledging what's there, which is what I talked about last week. It's once we've acknowledged what's there, really kind of hold it in awareness, then we want to take a closer look at it and see something deeper about it. What's going on there? Not take the surface impression we have of it, but really take it in. What's this? Really let it register and see what's there. And so insight comes from looking more deeply. And as some of you know, I'm very fond of the English word respect, because the spect part of respect means like spectacle, means to see. And the re means again. So respect means to look again. So vipassana has this aspect of looking more carefully, looking again, not just settling for the first impressions, but what is this really? So I'll talk more about that after we meditate, but I thought we would do a meditation now. So if you want to stand for a moment so you're fresher in your legs, you're welcome to do that. Sitting upright. So it's really good to give little emphasis on sitting upright. A little bit more upright than you normally would. Taking some care with your spine. Or maybe rather than upright, maybe it's feeling a teeny bit of aliveness or energy in your spine. And then gently closing your eyes. And it can be helpful to imagine that you're going to relax around that upright spine, like a strong column that stays strong. Then everything else falls to the side, relaxes. So perhaps taking a long, deep in-breath. And as you exhale, letting the shoulders fall away from the neck. Deep breath in. And as you exhale, perhaps let the rib cage fall away, relax. Taking a deep breath in, and as you exhale, perhaps you can soften your belly. As you exhale, perhaps you can soften the muscles and skin of your face, the jaws, the nose, the eyes. And then letting your breath breathe itself in a natural way. And then also as you begin, if it's easy enough, see if you can set yourself at ease. Let yourself be easy with how it is right now. Just a little lightening up or softening around your experience. So now, in a deliberate way, take your attention, your awareness, and place it in your right hand. And feel the sensations of your right hand. And notice what happens to those sensations of your palm, your fingers, your back of your hand. Warmth, coolness, tingling, pressure, vibration. So I just asked you to do two things. I asked you to apply your attention, or direct your attention to your right hand. And then I asked you to maintain the attention there. Hang out with the experience of the right hand. So in the same way now, first, direct your attention and apply it to your left hand. And once it's there, then maintain the attention, sustain the attention in your left hand. Hang in there, hang out with the sensations of your hand. And then in a moment, I'm going to ask you to move your attention again. And next time you move it, experiment with making that initial connection, initial placing your attention someplace. Make it, you know, something that's kind of clear or definitive or wholehearted. Not a kind of casual, kind of, oh, I'll get to it some point, or I'll just kind of hang out at the edges of it. But really, deliberately kind of really connect. And then once you're there, really be clear that for a few moments you're really going to hang in there with it and really experience it more fully, that experience. So move your attention now to your right knee and feel what goes on in your right knee. Make that connection and then hang in there. And in the same way, now clearly and definitively apply your attention to where your body touches the cushion or the chair. Move your attention and place it there, and then hang out with that, the sensations of contact there. Notice what happens to those sensations, the quality of them, the characteristics of them, their nature, as you stay and feel the contact. And then for whatever place in your body where you tend to experience your breathing, have that initial application of attention, clear, definitive, placing the attention there to experience the breath. Place it there. And then, once you're there, clearly kind of sustain the attention. Maintain it there, hang out there, with that experience of breathing. Being relaxed about it, but hanging in there with the breath to become more familiar with it, to get to know it, that experience better. Not to judge it, just to get to know it. And when your mind wanders away from the breathing, and it's time to come back to your breathing, in a gentle, relaxed way, make that initial returning to your breath clear and definitive, kind of a sense of deliberate, relaxed deliberateness. Really come back and connect. And then, once you connect there, sustain the attention there. Hang in there with it. So you're aware of the rhythm of breathing, the changing sensations over time. And if anything occurs while you're sitting here that's more compelling than your breathing, take that initial attention and apply it to that experience, whether it's sounds outside or sensations of your body or feelings or anything at all, and then clearly kind of make that connection to it, fully acknowledge it, and then do the second step, which is to hang in there and get to know it better. So take it in more fully. Feel it, sense it, as if you've never experienced it before. And you're going to take relaxed time to really be present for it and experience it and see what happens to it as you're present for it. breathing is one of the ways of noticing breathing, is to notice how much change there is in the experience of breathing. It's not a static, fixed experience, but it's in flux, expanding, contracting, movement. And as you maintain, sustain the attention, that sustaining of it allows you to see the change. Just a few minutes more, but step back and notice what's really happening here and now for you. Are you missing something? Or something more compelling than your breathing? And whatever it might be, brings clear initial application of attention to it, to really acknowledge it, and then sustain the attention. Maybe soften around it, but maintain the attention in it to see if you can notice anything that changes, or is it changing or moving or in flux around that experience. And then in the last minute of the sitting, take this minute to reflect a little bit, to remember what the sitting was like. To do so without any judgments about it, but very matter of fact. Notice, remember, get an overview of what the sitting was like for you. So, if I have a lousy day, and someone says, you know, how are you? Oh, it's a really lousy day. That's the predominant thing to talk about. So then in mindfulness, you're asked to bring mindfulness to that experience of a lousy day. That's the main thing going for you. What hopefully you realize very quickly is that a lousy day is an abstraction. It's a generalized kind of idea about, you know, about 12-hour period, perhaps. And you can't really bring that clear attention, that initial application of attention, to really connect to something that's abstract like that. You know, where do I find the day? It's everywhere, right? It's today, you know? And then you think about it, and was the whole day lousy? No. It wasn't the whole day. That was, you know, maybe three quarters of the day, but it's what sticks in my mind. But actually, I had a hilarious time at lunch at work today. It was like really funny. I couldn't believe it. And then once I left lunch and went back to work, it was lousy. You know, so it was only part of the day. And then was it all the time that you were at your desk in your office? No, it wasn't the whole time. It was only when I was being reminded of all the projects I have to do. And how often were you reminded of that? Oh, you know, it was actually whenever I checked my email. And how often you check your email? Oh, probably once every 30 minutes. And so, oh. So somehow the idea of a generalized idea of a lousy day, and you start investigating what actually made it up, it becomes something made up of particular things that cast a big spell or big interpretation over the whole day. Why this is important is that what we're trying to do in mindfulness is to connect to something which is concrete or tangible or real in the present moment. A lousy day, you can't do that. Now, it could be that feeling grumpy or upset is more concrete. So then you can say, okay, where is that upsetness? And so you find, oh, I'm upset. It's a lot of very fast thoughts, kind of downer kind of thoughts going on. Oh, certain kinds of thoughts. So what happens if I look carefully, sustain the attention, on the thinking mind that's having those thoughts? What you'll probably find is that those thoughts are not solid. Those thoughts are constantly shifting and changing. And in fact, they might not be the same kind of depressed, kind of upset thoughts, you know, constantly, but rather they're shifting and changing. There's other kind of thoughts that intersperse with them. There's gaps. Sometimes you forget to have lousy thoughts. Sometimes you think about, you know, the ball game today or something else, because, and then then back to the grumpiness when you remember, so you realize when you really look and connect that it's not so solid, or the emotions you have. Maybe you're feeling really afraid. So I'm really afraid. That's really what's going on. I'm a frightened person. The idea of being a frightened person is an abstraction. And you can't really bring clear mindfulness to a frightened person. But you can bring clear mindfulness to the experience of fear that's here. And where's the fear? Is it, you know, sometimes I've asked people, where's that fear? And they'll say, well, all of me is afraid. And I'll say, your little toe? Well, not my little toe. You know, your ankle? Not my ankle. And then he said, well, mostly, you know, it's in my torso. I feel this fear, you know, my chest and my belly. And your whole torso? And they said, well, it's mostly in the front half. You know, the back seems fine. You know, it's the belly and the chest is kind of agitated. But is it the whole chest? Well, no. If I look really carefully, really, I'm going to connect really to the experience of fear. It's a particular sensation, experience of tightness and vibration, of hardness, that's about the size of a tennis ball in my belly. Well, how do we get from all of me is afraid to just a tennis ball in my belly? If we stay with the abstraction, I'm a frightened person, you won't really see what's really there. And what we're trying to do in mindfulness is to find what can we connect to that's concrete, that's tangible, that's immediate, that's not an abstraction. So we can do that first step, putting the attention on something. So I can really notice and see something. So first you might notice, oh, here I'm thinking it's a lousy day. And then, okay, what can I really connect to in that experience? One thing that happens then is you're in the present moment. You're not thinking about the past and the future, even though the earlier part of the day was lousy. You're thinking, what can you connect to? It's here. And once you connect to what's here, what do you begin discovering when you start connecting to it? So you want to find what's tangible and immediate so you can really connect to something that's real. The past, as important as it is not real in a tangible way. The future is not real in a tangible way. The future is just a supposition. It's a prediction. So mindfulness unfolds, meditation unfolds, we begin finding something in the concrete immediate presence to bring the attention to. So then there's two steps. We apply the attention, which is one thing to do, it's one activity of the mind. And once you've applied it, we sustain it, we keep it there. Some people are very good at applying the attention. Notice something comes up, they'll apply it. But as soon as they've applied it, the mind drifts off. It doesn't stay there. Some people can be pretty good at sustaining it there, but then something new happens and doesn't occur to them to notice that. We bring attention to that. Some people are very casual about the noticing. Oh, you know, there's a sound and I'll get around to paying attention to something else soon and there's an itch, you know. It's like, there's kind of like a little bit casual or non-committal or... The idea in mindfulness is in a relaxed way to really make contact with experience, really acknowledge and really feel and be present for it. So as a car goes by, and if that's really the predominant experience of the moment, we really take in that experience of motor sound, car sound, experience it, vibration, movement, you know, whatever it might be. Sometimes when I hear sounds of cars going by here, depending where the car is, I often hear it mostly on one side of my head, mostly. That's where the vibrations come in. So I feel, oh, the vibration's there. I feel the activity there of hearing in that side of me. And then sounds are interesting because if you really connect to the sound of a car moving, driving by, one of the things you become aware of is that it changes. It might first be faint, then get stronger, and then it gets fainter, and then disappears. You can feel it rise and come. So then, maybe some of you could tell me a little bit about what that meditation was like. These two steps, applying the attention and then sustaining the attention. What did that do for your meditation to learn those two steps and to emphasize them? Yes, so if we can...
Well, for me tonight, I was very distractible. So I was very easy for me to focus on my hand or focus on my knee, but then I would leap off to something else pretty quickly.
So the initial application was easy, but then you couldn't sustain it.
Yeah.
So that was the muscle that needs to be developed, the sustaining of something.
Right, and then, which was actually going to lead to a question I have, which you may or may not want to answer now, but I feel like there's a, I don't know how to draw the line between ignoring stuff and not being aware, and jumping from one thing to another and saying, oh, well, I'm not being mindful because I'm not mindful of the sound. I'm busy concentrating on my breath. So it's like there's a trade-off in my mind between mindfulness and concentration.
Yeah.
Is that a false dichotomy?
No. The basic idea here is to, you don't have to notice everything. You know, you don't have to bring clear mindfulness to everything that goes on. It's just too much. But what you can do is just bring clear mindfulness to what is the most compelling experience. And so if there's a sound that's compelling, then let go of your breath and take in the sound. If the sound is not compelling, it's kind of in the background, you can just basically ignore it. And mostly we can ignore things that are in the background. Occasionally we have to bring attention to it because something's not being attended to. But the basic idea is if it's in the background, let it be there. If it's not distracting you from paying attention to what's in the foreground, just leave it there. But when something comes into the foreground, that's when you want to turn your attention and place your attention on it and experience it more fully.
But if I'm too distractible, right, does that change things?
Yes, of course. So if you're distractible, then what you want to do is turn your attention to what it's like to be a distractible person. Or not, that's not the way you should do it, given what I said earlier. But turn your attention. And what's that experience of distractibility like for you? So the very thing that's making it hard for you to be present becomes, that's the compelling thing, that's the object of attention. So you might feel that there's a lot of racing thoughts, so you bring your attention, really feel, what's the experience of racing thoughts like? How can I connect to that and just sense that, the energy of it, the speed of it, the harshness of it? Or perhaps there's a lot of emotions that are unsettled emotions that are part of it. So, okay, so man, I really connect to the unsettled emotions as part of being distractible. So you notice what's happening. What's happening for you in a compelling way is distractibility, being distracted a lot. So that becomes the object of attention. And so given that's what's going on, what about it can you really connect to?
So I think what happens for me is even in that case, if I try to pay attention, it's okay, and say, okay, I feel a little restless, a little jumpy, and then, you know, I guess that's what it feels like to be distractible. Then a car goes by and I get distracted by it.
Mm, it's okay.
Okay.
And
but I'm not sure how focusing on what it feels like to be distractible really adds anything in that situation.
It adds a lot. That's what's happening in the present moment. And we're training ourselves to be present for what's present. So that's what's going on. So you're training yourself, you're in the present moment if you're with your distractible. If you're paying attention to it, really noticing it. If you're just lost in it, it's not useful. But you notice, oh, this is an experience of being distracted a lot, to have a restless mind. You really notice, this is what it's like. Then you're in the present moment. And then as you're present for it, then you can learn how to be present in a useful way so you don't get pulled away by the distracting thoughts. So it's kind of like Aikido. You turn into the very thing which is the problem, and you bring your hold that in attention.
I think I'm going to have to work on that because that seems hard to get my head wrapped around.
Because if you're distracted, then you can't do anything.
Well, not that so much, but also like I still feel like even paying attention to this is what it feels like to be distractible is a distraction in and of itself, and so then I'm still not concentrating on something.
You're concentrating on that.
Yeah.
So that's the basic approach to mindfulness. You actually would take, if that's what's compelling, you would actually learn to how to be present for that. Now it helps not to keep it abstract, but to find out what are the particulars tangible about that experience, emotionally, physically, mentally, cognitively, what's going on in the present moment. If you find yourself, you know, over and over again, restlessly kind of getting lost in your thoughts, then perhaps rather than focusing on it that way, maybe then concentration is useful. Or then the you may want to maybe have greater strength, apply yourself more actively at these two steps. So next time you go back to your breath, do it with a little more emphasis. I'm really going to connect to the breath now. So you're really kind of like planting a stake in the sand or something, whatever the expression is. Okay, I'm going to be here. and then have a little more strength in sustaining the attention. And sometimes when the mind is very restless, it's very useful to actually counter it with some strength of determination. And, you know, who's going to be stronger? You or it? So you can, sometimes that's useful, and sometimes what's useful to turn towards it and really acknowledge it and see it and soften around it. So someone else. Yes, Alicia.
I really appreciate it that in this meditation, it was like a gift to me to be able to turn my attention towards something that's a distraction and to sustain it, because I find that there's inclinations for me sometimes to, when I'm distracted, especially to things that are unpleasant, to say, well, get back to your meditation and try to get silent and quiet the mind and all of that. But I felt like in the longer sustainability of my attention towards something, that there was more ease to be had, because I gave myself permission to be with it.
Good, beautiful. So you're not in conflict with it or pushing it away or trying to avoid it, but just being with it. And that's one of the things we can learn, is not to be in conflict with things, but just to be present in a lighter, kinder way.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a great way of kind of getting to know myself a little bit.
Yeah, and then you can get, and then also you get to know it better. And that's one of the aspects of mindfulness, to really see more clearly what's really there.
Right.
Great. Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you. Yes, please. Oh, yes, please.
I'll make it quick. At the very end of our meditation, when you said we've got 3 minutes left, and I think you said something like, ask yourself what's really going on, or ask yourself like what you're not looking at. And I felt like you read my mail. And I just felt like someone just pulled my covers, and I just felt really unsafe.
Oh.
So I stayed with it, and I realized it's the economy, and I can't control that. I can do something about it, but I'm feeling really unsafe about the economy. And then I just realized that I am safe right now.
Beautiful. So what I was saying afterwards then, that the economy was an abstraction. It's real in some certain kind of way. It has a big impact on us. But it's also an abstraction. You can't really kind of put your finger on the economy, right? And so in the present moment, what's the present moment experience?
The present moment is that I'm very safe.
Very safe. And so that's a very profound realization. And many times when people are anxious, they're anxious about something which is not right here and now. And sometimes if you just look around and say, well, is there any danger right here? And they go, no, not here. Thank you.
When I started to concentrate on the different parts of my body, I found it very interesting, because I've never done that before. But the difficulty was just breathing and turning off my mind. Thay says people get bored.
Is what? They get bored?
Bored. They get bored, or they want to fall asleep or something. And that's how I felt. It was a hard time sustaining that, just that breathing. Is it because my mind is always thinking too much?
Yeah.
So how do you get to that point where you can just breathe for, say, 20 minutes and reach a sort of calm?
There's a variety of things it's a good question, and there's a variety of things that support that ability to really stay focused on what's doing and get calm. One of them, developing strength in the mindfulness. So the mindfulness is strong. It's like a muscle that gets stronger. Like if someone is going to memorize, do a lot of memorization, the more you work on memorization, the stronger that muscle of memorization becomes. The more you develop your mindfulness, the stronger that muscle of mindfulness becomes. Another thing that happens is that you start having some understanding about what goes on in your inner life. And there's a lot of things we can understand. One of the things we understand is the things that we're concerned about maybe are not so important for us to be focusing on. The allure, the seduction of our different things we're thinking about begins to lose their appeal.
Well, when you say develop that muscle, can you be a little bit more precise or clearer? I don't understand it.
So it's just like, have you ever exercised or ever learned a musical instrument? Or And have you noticed that when you keep practicing, that's your skill develops?
So just in that particular area of just breathing, just keep breathing.
So if you keep focused on your breath, coming back to the breath over and over and stay there, that capacity to focus and stay present becomes stronger.
Okay.
And you know, for example, musicians discover that, even they don't not necessarily by trying, but in order to play a musical instrument, you have to be in the present moment and be focused on the present, the music. And some musicians find that the side effect of that is they develop greater concentration and focus over time.
So pretty soon you won't be bored?
If you're really present, really give yourself over to the experience of breathing, really there for it, you will not be bored.
Okay.
You'll be delighted. Okay. Anybody else want to say something? Yes, George.
Okay. Posture. My wife tells me I slouch. And so, okay. So I slouch and then I say, yeah, but I'm meditating now. And I do your exercise is good at the beginning where you yeah. sit up straight and then you let go. But in order to keep the straight spine, what I found was way into the meditation, I kept saying, oh, yeah, posture, posture. But then I realized that even when I paid attention and straightened up, I was still slouching. So near the end, I said, come on, straight. And I went straight. Now, when I go straight, it takes effort. So I think I know the answer that if it feels like effort, but if I just stay there and either look at it or don't look at it, someday... I will be comfortable in that straight position, but right now it's a drag, you know.
So you have to make a decision about what to do about that.
Yeah.
In the long term, you're much better off developing that ability to hold yourself straight and upright, and it takes effort and all that. But for someone who's relatively new to meditation, it can be discouraging to always be working on that. And so then you don't want to meditate because you're always just focusing on not meditating, you're posturing. And so then it's, I mean, if you're not going to meditate at all because meditation just means working on your posture, then maybe you're better off slouching so that you meditate. So there's a trade-off there. And how you're going to work that trade-off is your choice. And maybe there's some kind of balance between those two approaches.
This wasn't a constant thing. It was once in a while I go, whoop. You know,
yeah, if it's once in a while, maybe you don't have to worry about it.
Then. I don't have to worry. Thank you.
Okay. So one of the things I was trying to introduce today is that attention has different elements or different aspects to it. Attention is not just one kind of vague thing, but there's different component parts of attention. And one part of attention is the applying of the attention on an object, on something, some experience. And that we can do that deliberately and with some clarity, some oomph or something that really definitively, oh yeah, I'm here, I'm really going to pay attention to that. I'm aware of the sound outside of a car. Oh yeah, I'm aware of the sound. That's very different than saying, oh, there's a sound, let me really be there for it. It's kind of almost like you turn towards it and be there, really let it come in fully. So that initial kind of allowing yourself to really connect is a very helpful part of attention because then you're really there. If you're kind of, you know, casual about it, then you're not really present. The second aspect of attention that I'm talking about today is the aspect of then staying with the attention there, sustaining it, hanging in there with the experience. And that's kind of like a different muscle. The muscle of applying is one muscle. The muscle of staying is something else. And so then that's a very important part of mindfulness, to hang in there. And one helpful idea is the idea that you're hanging in there so that you can get to know it better. You're not just hanging in there for the purpose of hanging in there, but you're hanging in there to let it register more fully, to feel it more fully, to experience it more fully, to notice what's going on more fully. And as we begin to notice it more and more fully, one of the very important aspects of this mindfulness practice is to notice how it changes. Because everything changes. It might not change the way you want it to change, or as quickly as you want it to change, or as slowly as you want it to change. But everything is in flux and in movement. And it's in change in different ways. It's not just like one kind of way it changes. So, for example, the sound we just heard of the squawking bird outside. You hear that? There, it stopped, right? So it changed in two ways. It was there for a while squawking, and then it stopped. That's one way of changing. The other way is within that span of time that it was squawking, the squawks themselves were intermittent. Squawk, stop. Squawk, stop. So there was change within the larger context of change. If you're very, very acutely mindful, you'll also notice that that each squawk itself varied in intensity within the squawk. You know, that was very brief, so maybe it's hard to see. But it's like the car going by. You hear it faintly first, and it gets stronger, and then it goes away. So within the experience of it being there, there's a variety of intensities. So there's three different kinds of change just in the squawk. What about when you're feeling angry? If you're just kind of thought, I'm an angry person, that's an abstraction. You can't really do mindfulness on an angry person. Because we say in Buddhism that an angry person doesn't exist. Isn't that nice? what exists is anger. And so, because an angry person you can't really connect to. You can't bring mindfulness tangibly to that. But you can bring mindfulness tangibly to the experience of anger. And so you connect to the anger. And part of the idea of connecting to it first, is the initial application, is that it's okay for it to be there. It's okay. Whatever you bring your attention to, there's a way in which, oh, it's okay. I'll soften around it. It's okay. I'm just going to be there for it. So I'm going to be, it's okay to be, I have anger. I'm going to be there for it. And then, so when I connect to the experience of anger, what am I aware of? So what are some of the things you might be aware of tangibly when you're angry? Because the guy you're angry with, he's not here. So you can't talk about him, because he's like somewhere else. So what is it that you can tangibly aware of about anger here and now? Not that any of you are angry, but what theoretically?
Feel your pulse go up.
Feel your pulse go up. Okay, that's something that's changing in a variety of ways. It's gone up, it's gotten stronger, it's also oscillating. What else? Judgments. Now, if you really turn towards that mind that's thinking, making those judgments, what do you notice about those thoughts, that thinking process?
Contraction.
There's contraction around those thoughts, okay. And now, are those thoughts solid? Do they come and go? Do they change in some of the different ways I talked about? They're there for a while, then they stop, like the squawking stopped. They're also, the judgments squawk intermittently.
Well, it's like the elephant. It's like my judgment of the situation is my judgment, and as many people as in this room could have a different judgment of the same situation, and especially the person I'm angry at probably has a whole different aspect. So it's really abstract.
It's just really abstract. So realize that when you look at the judgment, There's a wisdom that sees, oh, this is an abstraction, it's an interpretation, and it's maybe, you know, it's maybe a prejudiced interpretation, and so that's wisdom. But then if you look at it more carefully, so you see when you look at the judgment, you see it's kind of ephemeral or kind of not so solid. You might also see that the very words, the sentences you tell yourself, judgment kind of like a sentence is in the mind, that lousy guy, how could he have done that? Those saying those thoughts is an impermanent phenomena. They come and go. There's gaps between them. And so you see, oh, just they come and they go. They float through the mind. They're quite strong right now. Other times they're weak. And you can see the changing nature of having those thoughts. And so when you see that those kinds of thoughts, those kind of judgments are changing and in flux, then there's a tendency for some people to lighten up around it. We don't take them as being so solid, so absolute. And we don't also tend to see, this is who I am. I'm not an angry, judgmental person. There's intermittent judgments going on. There's actually gaps between them if you look carefully. Does it make sense? Enough?
Sometimes anger is also a diving board that lets me jump off it and have that extra chocolate chip cookie or another cup of coffee because I deserve it. So, going through such a hard time.
Yeah. So that's a very important thing to also notice is the function that some of these emotions might have for us, the impact it has on us. Right now, for the mindfulness, that's wisdom that's operating and sees that. Mindfulness just tries to see clearly in and of itself what it is. So what else might we be aware of if you're aware of anger?
Tightness.
So if you bring your attention to the tightness, how do you experience that tightness?
It's also in a process of changing. When I first notice it, it might be really intense. It might even get more intense as I bring my awareness to it, and then something else, arises. Maybe that tension isn't really prominent.
So part of what anger is if you want to connect to something tangible and immediate in the present moment about anger, you might be aware of the contraction or the tightness that there might be there. If you bring careful attention to it, you apply the attention to that tightness, and then you sustain the attention to get to know it better. And if you get to know it better, how does it change?
But in another present moment down the line, if you're trying to become more productive and positive, that anger should dissipate over another present moment.
It could, yes. But right now, the focus is not so much on, that's kind of a wisdom statement. Right now, what I'm trying to do is to help you understand what it's like to just simply bring mindfulness to an experience you're having. So what's the experience, what's the immediate experience of anger like without judging it or interpreting it or thinking about the future around it? What are you aware of if you're tangibly aware of it? And what happens to that tangible, immediate experience as you begin looking at it more carefully?
Another thing you're aware of is your mood. Like, it might become more irritable, more reactive.
And where is that mood in your little toe?
No.
So where is the...
It's nowhere.
Nowhere?
Yeah.
Oh, really? How would you know you had a mood if it was nowhere?
How do I know that I have thoughts? Oh. I just know that I'm having them.
Yeah, I don't... without any location?
Maybe they feel like they're in my head sometimes. I don't know.
Where's the all the energy? So when you've just robbed the bank and the police are chasing you and you have a lot of thoughts about being caught, where are the thoughts? Where's the energy of thinking for you? Not that you do that, but...
Right. Most of the time I would fall... I personally feel like I'm thinking up here in my head somewhere, but...
So a mood also then. Where's that mood reside?
For me, my mood probably feels mostly up in my head and in my torso.
So then if you bring your attention more closely in, and what sensations in your head or your torso let you know that you're having this mood?
I don't know. To me, the word mood means different than physical sensation.
Mm-hmm. But still, there's an intimate connection between mood and emotions and the physical aspects of it. Chances are you wouldn't know what mood you had unless there was some physical evidence that was part of it.
Yeah, what I was trying to get at was, in addition to the physical sensation,
there's also the mood.
There is also mood.
Yeah, yeah. It's quite quite relevant to what I'm asking that you mentioned that. But then how do you bring careful attention to the experience of mood? And so what we're trying to do here, what I'm trying to show you is you want to kind of look beyond the veil of interpretation or abstraction and see what's actually tangible and immediate in my experience that I can actually connect to. Once we can connect to something more tangible or immediate, then we start seeing how it changes. And then things can change in you might notice one of three things. Whatever the experience is, can get weaker and go away. It can get stronger, more intense, or it can stay the same. Those are the three options. Yes?
What do you do when, teaching us to bring our attention You're teaching us to bring our attention.
We need a mindfulness of microphone.
So you're teaching us to bring our attention to a particular thing and then sustain it. And then you were giving an example of anger, and different people were giving different answers. And I was thinking, I've been meditating, and when I bring my attention to the anger, it intensifies like a firebomb. And I'm so afraid to stay with it, because if I stay with it, I'm going to explode.
Uh-huh. Could be.
And it's,
so you notice that the change that you notice is it gets stronger.
I mean, immediately. And uh-huh. The same thing, another thing that came up was just pain. If I think about something and bring my attention, the pain intensifies to the point where I'll be crying and as I'm meditating. And so I can direct my attention, can sustain it, then, but what do I do when it's so intense?
So one of the things we do also in this mindfulness is, as we bring our attention to some experience, we're also part of the picture, part of the what's going on is also how we relate to the experience. So there are some people, for example, who might experience fear, and the fear triggers more fear because we're afraid of the fear. And then there's more fear, and then we're afraid of that fear, and pretty soon there's a full-blown panic attack. We have a relationship with the fear. We got involved in it. We believe it. We're concerned about it. With anger, some people might feel the anger, and then they feel really justified and feel really self-righteous or really hurt. And so they feel the anger, and that triggers more anger. That discomfort and more anger then triggers more because we're involved in it in some way. So you might look and see that as you look at, when you bring your attention to anything like pain, are you involved somehow? Do you kind of lock down? Do you bear down? Do you zero in on it in a very intense way? And perhaps that's not a useful way of paying attention for you. Maybe what you need to do is when you bring attention to something, maybe you need to find a very spacious mind, very open, wide, like open space kind of mind that just kind of, I'm not going to bear down on it. I'm not going to push down on it or zero in like a laser on it. I'm just going to back away from it. Just hold it in awareness, like I'm 10 feet away from my anger. And from 10 feet away, I'm just going to kind of just be present and see, look at it and be present for it. And then you might find that the intensity that's building up for you won't build up. It's possible. I don't know you well enough, but that's what I would recommend you start experimenting with. So, what this mindfulness tradition emphasizes is the tremendous usefulness of being in the present moment. The usefulness, when you're in the present moment, to take your attention and let your attention be tangible or concrete. Don't pay attention to abstractions, but here and now, what is it that's really going on? And then to really kind of connect to that tangible experience. So, for example, with the breathing, one way that some people stay kind of in abstractions around paying attention to the breath is rather than paying attention to the tangible experience of breathing, they pay attention to an image they have, visualization they have of the breathing. So I've known people, for example, who, when they're with their breathing, they imagine it's a big water wheel that's turning around. And they were kind of with that water wheel. It's really with an image rather than with something. Image is an abstraction. What's tangible? What can you really connect to? What you can connect to, perhaps, for example, is the expansion of the rib cage, the movement of the ribs going out and coming back, moving out and coming back. That's tangible, expansion and contraction. So first, it's important to be in the present moment, and then we start bringing attention to what can clearly, directly be experienced, not abstracted about, interpreted about, but in the direct experience. It's very forgiving, this meditation practice, then, because there's no need to judge it or interpret your experience. You can just allow the experience to be what it is. And then you want to experiment with developing some strength in that definitive placing the attention on something. So you're really there for it. You don't want to try too hard because then you get kind of tense or something. You want to be relaxed about all this. But there's a kind of relaxed, definitive, wait, this is what I'm doing. I'm really going to be here with this experience. A full acknowledgement. And then the second thing is you want to sustain the attention with it so you can notice something more deeply about it. Notice it more carefully. One of the things you might notice is that what you thought you were paying attention to is really an abstraction. I'm feeling like I'm having a lousy day. Okay, I'm experiencing a lousy day. Well, I can't really quite get it, but I can get it, feel a lot of tension. So I'll feel the tension that's maybe part of that. So you start kind of teasing apart the interpretations from the direct experience. We keep coming back to the direct experience. And then what is it you can directly know? And how does, when you directly know something, you get to know it, stay, hang out with something for a little while. Don't just kind of notice something and go on to the next thing. Let it register in your system, in your sense world, what that experience is like. And then notice how it changes, if it changes. And in fact, everything changes. If you think it's not changing, maybe you haven't looked carefully enough, gotten close enough to it. I mean, you almost need to put a magnifying glass of attention and look really carefully what's there. So then start noticing how it changes. Now, in Buddhism, to actually see change, not to believe that everything changes, that's something else, but to really see that things are changing is a source of tremendous wisdom and a source of tremendous freedom. And for one reason is that when you see things are always changing, we don't succumb to that delusion of permanence. And a lot of the suffering, a fair amount of suffering that human beings have, is connected to this idea of delusion of permanence, or the clinging to permanence, wanting things to be the same in some way. And if we start seeing things are always changing, sometimes it might be frightening or a little bit disconcerting to see things are changing, but as we get a hang of it, we see how things are changing in flux all the time. It actually helps us to free up that tendency to cling and to grasp and to resist, and things can go through in a much lighter, easier way. Our experiences can be much more easy to have as we allow them just to flow and move and change. Anger can arise, and we say, oh, that's just one of those kinds of moments, the anger moments, as opposed to, uh-oh, this is really dangerous, I'm a terrible person now, and we locked onto the anger. We don't want to act on the anger, but we want to just anger in the moment. I see it arise, I'll connect to it with my attention and watch it, and then it's watch it and see how it changes and morphs and the energy moves through your body. There's a lot more ease possible when you see things that are changing. So one of the so-called goals of mindfulness meditation is to be present enough so that change reveals itself to you. And I say that very carefully. It isn't that you're supposed to go out looking for change. It's more like as you sustain the attention, really stay and hang in there for the experience, one of the things that happens at some point, the changing aspect of experience will come to you. And as you really take this in deeper and deeper, your experience of yourself, of the world you live in, will change in a beautiful way. And one of the things that many people eventually come to when they really take in the changing nature of the immediate experience they're in is one of the beautiful things that can happen is a very profound trust in the changing flow of experience. And the sense of being able to really be able to sit back and trust what emerges out of you, what comes out of you. It's okay for it to arise. Not that it's wise, but you can trust the flow and the change, the process of life as it comes through. If you can kind of get out of the way and don't get involved in it, don't latch onto it, don't start playing with it. It's a beautiful, deep trust in what comes through and comes out of us or through us or works through us. And that beautiful trust is one of the great gifts of this kind of mindfulness practice, where we're not opposed or in conflict to all the changing phenomena that come in moving through us, but we see it as part of the dance of life, we see it as a beautiful part of being free, is to allow these things to happen and come through us. As we see the changing nature of things more clearly, it also tends to give birth to a lot more wisdom, deeper understanding. Some of the things you mentioned today were wisdom understandings. But the more and more is available as we see that, and then we live in a wiser way as well. So for this week, what I would like to encourage you to do at home is to try experimenting, play around with these two aspects of attention, the initial application of attention and the sustained application of attention. As you sustain the attention, see if you can find what's tangible in your experience in the here and now. And then see if you can, as you become more familiar with what's really real, see if you can notice if any quality of it is changing, any aspect of it is changing. And as you're aware of the changing aspect of it, how does that change your relationship to it? Is that clear enough? Yes. So there's a little bit of this is in the handout. So experiment with how you might use this initial application of attention and the sustained application of attention. As you stay with an experience, sustain the attention on something, something tangible, something immediate, then start noticing, get to know it better, become more familiar with it. Let it register more fully what this experience is like. As you get to know it better, see if you start noticing change, the impermanent qualities of it, how it changes over time, in the various ways it might change. And then as you see a change, see if that, just in seeing the change, whether that might lighten or relax or open up how you relate to it, how you are with it. So that's a lot of steps. Even if you see the first two things, it's be plenty good enough. And since that was a lot to remember, there's a handout here with it says kind of review some of this briefly, and then it also gives you a little bit more of a homework to do at the end of your meditation session. Those of you who found this useful might want to then do this one as well at the end of your meditation. And so I hope that was helpful, and thank you very much, and I hope you find your meditations fruitful.